Hello, everyone, and welcome to True Crime Talkers San Diego, episode number 11. I'm your host, Jamie, and today, as you can probably guess from the title, we're going to be talking about the crimes against the homeless. So let's jump right into today's news story. Although the city of San Diego is a very beautiful and amazing city to live in, it definitely is not perfect. One of the major issues our city faces is the crisis of homelessness. We have the nation's fifth largest homeless population, according to an annual report Housing and Urban Development Count done in January of 2019. As of January 2020, the annual point in time count found 7,658 homeless people throughout all of the San Diego County, which is actually a 5% decrease from 2019. Which is, yay, that's something, that's good, right? Yeah. But of that number, nearly 4,000 were without shelter. This is obviously a very serious problem, especially as of recent circumstances. A year ago, when this little thing called COVID-19 arose, our city had to make a decision on how we can help prevent the spread of COVID amongst our homeless population. So some people were put into hotels while other homeless people were housed in the convention center. The challenge of COVID has really rejuvenated and brought the homeless crisis back to the forefront of many San Diego officials. I know personally as a kid growing up in San Diego, whenever my mom was driving us around downtown, I would look out the car window and sometimes see people laying on benches or on the sidewalks. It just always made me feel sad. It didn't sit right with me knowing that some people don't have a home to go to at the end of the day. According to my mom, though, I came up with a pretty good idea to help out the homeless community. Apparently, when I was around, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6, I told my mother that we should go plant a bunch of trees all around the city so that any homeless person would have a nice shady place to rest. I mean, my heart was definitely in the right place, but the practicality and functionality of that plan could definitely use some work. Thankfully, we have actual officials and San Diegans executing much better solutions than mine, and I'm very glad to see that they could come up with a solution in regards to the pandemic affecting the homeless community. Today, COVID is becoming to come under somewhat of control. I am happy to report that I actually got my second vaccine this morning, so I'm all good to go, and I'm super, super stoked about that. So yeah, things are starting to slowly get back to normal, and due to this, the convention center has relocated its homeless residents to other facilities, as well as back onto the streets. Last week, a group of homeless people were camping in tents within a tunnel on B Street, west of 16th and east of Park Boulevard. And then the top of this tunnel is actually part of the community college there. I know I've actually passed through this tunnel probably a handful of times, and it is a really good spot to kind of get away, get under from the rain and the cold, which is exactly what these people were doing. So on March 15th, around 9 a.m., a Volvo station wagon jumped the curb at this tunnel and ended up plowing into the group. Tragically, Randy Ferris, Walter Jones, and Rodney DeFindel were killed, and 7 others were injured as well. The driver of this vehicle got out and tried to help the victims. The police soon arrived on scene, and the driver cooperated with them, and he identified himself as 71-year-old Craig Voss. The police suspect that Craig was driving under the influence of drugs, so Mr. Voss was then given a sobriety test and arrested. The SDPD have also said that shortly before the crash, the department received a radio call of a possibly impaired driver, and the description of that car matched Voss's Volvo. Last Tuesday, Craig Voss pleaded not guilty to charges of gross vehicular manslaughter, driving under the influence of drugs, and causing injury. He now faces more than 20 years in prison if convicted of all the charges, which at his age would basically be a life sentence. So that's pretty much all the information we know so far. The authorities have not yet disclosed what sort of drug they suspect Craig may have been on that impaired his driving, but one thing is clear. This crash is another recent incident that has intensified the spotlight on the homeless community in San Diego. Today, we're talking about John David Guerrero, a man who terrorized and brutalized the homeless community for months. This story takes place in January of 2016. John was 39 years old at the time, and he had recently moved out on his own and was living in a one-room apartment on the fifth floor at Alpha Square. Alpha Square is a $46 million mixed-use apartment building that's funded by tax dollars, investment corporations, and the San Diego Housing Commission through the Alpha Project. This complex is located in downtown San Diego and has 201 affordable rental units, with about 20% of the units serving specialized populations, including seniors, disabled, and homeless residents. From my understanding, this place is used as a location to house low-income people and also helps give tools for these people to succeed and overcome poverty. They do this by providing in-house case management and support services. They also have helpful amenities such as a computer lab, laundry facilities, and a commercial kitchen for resident meals. There's a street-level space reserved for income-producing micro-enterprises, which are intended to provide training and employment opportunities for the Alpha Square residents. I had not heard about this place before my research, and from the article in the San Diego Union-Tribune, it sounds like a great place with a really good purpose. However, it does have mixed reviews from the residents online, and people have actually rated it a 3.5 stars. So, I'm just going to read a couple of the reviews so we can get a better understanding of what people who have actually lived there say. So, one person wrote, "They do great work for those who are in a bad spot and are willing to put in the work and rise above their circumstances. Staff is knowledgeable and friendly, and this is a place that will help you assess barriers to obtain housing." Another person wrote, "Alpha Project is a wonderful place. They reach out to the homeless, help you get back on track in regards to health, shelter, shoes, clothes, hygiene, and food. The program is for those who want to do something about yourself instead of being on the ground." So those two reviews were obviously rated at 5 stars. You know, they're very positive. But now I want to read you a couple 1-star ratings so that way we can hear both the good, the bad, and the ugly. One person writes, "Another fake homeless company only designed to make themselves rich and dodge out on taxes." Another review is, "The Alpha Square is another scam. All that money that comes from the people living there goes right into the owner's pocket. If you truly want to help out the homeless, stop helping the Alpha Project and stop using St. Vinny's. These two companies are only becoming more and more richer, while the homeless problem becomes worse. Look at how the owner is living. Look at his house. For a non-profit company, he sure makes his million a year." So, based on the reviews, people either love or hate this project, which is very evident based on the star ratings alone. It's pretty rare for me to see a place with a lot of 5-star and 1-star ratings at the same time, with only a couple ratings in the middle. It seems great. And it is a place for people to go, and it seems to have given some people a chance to turn their life around. But if it's built on a scam, then I can understand why people would be so upset. John Guerrero stayed at this complex back in 2016. He's obviously spent a good deal of time around homeless people, and he's technically a part of that community since he qualifies to live at Alpha Square. Knowing this, you would think John would have more sympathy for the homeless people on the streets. One would think he might even empathize with them. So it's truly shocking to learn that he soon targets the most vulnerable in our community and commits crimes that can only be described as brutal, gruesome, and horrific. Shortly after John has settled into his new home at Alpha Square, a string of attacks begins in the downtown area. The first occurs in February when a man was jolted from sleep on a loading dock in the East Village. He was brutally stabbed in the face. When the victim asks the stranger why he was being attacked, John replies, "Because you're a bum." After that, the next 4 months are pretty quiet. But in late June, a string of violent attacks occurs involving two men, and then 2 days later, a woman. Thankfully, all three survived, but John's hunger for violence turns even more deadlier. On July 3rd, Anthony DiNardo, a 53-year-old man, was sleeping on the street under the I-5. He was suddenly awoken to a searing pain in his head and chest. John had impaled the man with railroad spikes and then proceeded to set him on fire. Isn't that just so sick? Oh my god, I just don't understand what would compel someone to torture another person in such a way. Oh, oof. Being tortured is like my worst nightmare. I can't imagine. The police are called, and witnesses tell them that they had spotted a man running away carrying a gas can with him. John actually does get away, and the next day, on July 4th, Sean Longley is stabbed and murdered with a railroad spike as he was sleeping at an Ocean Beach park. 2 days after that, on July 6th, Dionichi Gahadi, I'm so sorry if I said that wrong, I probably did, but he was sleeping under a towel in downtown when a man on a bike lit that towel on fire. This badly burned the 23-year-old, and sadly he died 4 days later. The fourth attack was on July 13th, when an 83-year-old Molly Simmons was walking to a bus stop in North Park. She was on her way to volunteer at a YMCA when she suddenly struck in the back of her head. The force of that blow caused her to suffer a skull fracture and a brain bleed, and consequently, she died a few weeks later. So, as you can tell at this point, John has a very specific way of killing people. He really likes his railroad spikes, and he really likes playing with fire. So at this point, the police still have no idea that John is the serial killer behind these brutal killings. However, they were able to find out that the gas can involved in the first murder was bought at a nearby convenience store. The SDPD requests the surveillance tape from that store in an attempt to ID the buyer. Apparently, the store clerk, known as Elliot, sold it to Guerrero about 15 minutes before the first deadly attack. Elliot's last name is not mentioned for privacy, but he does play a major role in this case. At the time of the purchase, Elliot had no idea that he was face to face with a serial killer, and their interaction was nothing out of the ordinary to him. People often run out of gas, and they come in for a can and gas, and then they usually take it out to their car. To him, this was just a normal transaction. Elliot didn't realize how serious the incident was until two more homeless men were attacked, and the police came looking for that security video. Initially, the footage from the store was very fuzzy, and it was really hard for the police to clearly see who had bought that gas from Elliot. The SDPD does make an arrest, however, believing that a man named Anthony Paget was the killer. Both John Guerrero and Anthony Paget have similar features. Anthony has actually served 4 years in prison for setting his homeless friend on fire. So you could see the connection. He definitely has the history of committing a similar crime, so I could see why the police would believe that he was the killer. However, when the police announced that they made an arrest, Elliot knew that they had the wrong guy. So the SDPD returned to Elliot for a description of the suspect and asked if he'd be willing to help a police sketch artist draw up a composite sketch. Elliot, of course, agrees and gave the description to the best of his memory. This was huge for the case, because within 48 hours of releasing that sketch, an SD officer was able to recognize and arrest John Guerrero in Bankers Hill. The same day of his arrest, on July 15th, John had managed to attack two more men within an hour apart of each other. One of the last victims was 58-year-old Mike Papadelis. Thankfully, Mike did survive his attack, and he's able to go on and tell his tale. He had been sleeping on the sidewalk when he was suddenly awoken to John pounding a spike into his face. This left Mike with a crushed eye socket, leaving him blind in the right eye, as well as suffering a broken nose and jaw. In an interview with NBC7, Mike Papadelis says, quote, "I'm lucky to be alive because the railroad spike was there and I was asleep. He could have put it right through my head or my chest or my neck, but I don't know. I guess it just wasn't my time." I mean, yeah, definitely very lucky. I can't imagine being waking up to something as gruesome as that. Ugh. When John Guerrero was arrested, his clothes were splattered with blood, and in his backpack, police found a small sledgehammer and railroad spikes. I mean, if that's not damning evidence, I don't know what is. So, in total, John had killed four victims, three of which were homeless, and had violent attacks on several other individuals. The only motive that was ever really given from John was in the first attack, when he said he attempted to murder because the victim was a bum. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a bit confused by John's violence against the homeless, since he seemed to be living a quote-unquote bum lifestyle himself. It's not like, you know, he was some hotty-totty business executive who had a hatred or prejudice against the poor. He was living at Alpha Square, surrounded by people who were down on their luck and seeking out help. To me, that place seems to be like a halfway house to get people into a more permanent housing of their own. So, why was David there if he wasn't in a similar situation as these other bums? You can't see, but I was doing air quotes. I didn't read that John had a job at this time, but honestly, even if he did, how the heck did he find the free time and the energy to go out violently attacking people night after night for weeks? So, I don't think he had a job. He's living in low-income areas, which those together are fine, but why hate on people in a very similar situation as yourself? So, I honestly don't think it was a prejudice issue. I think that John just believed that he could get away with these crimes because he was attacking vulnerable people, people who were asleep on the street, and he probably thought these were people who may not have anyone coming to look for them, which is a super sad thought. After his arrest, John was sent to Patton State Hospital for treatment after being found not competent to stand trial in July of 2017. Sadly, it does turn out that John Guerrero suffers from schizophrenia and has spent a lifetime in and out of jail or institutions for this very reason. Interestingly though, from the story, you know, one would think that John maybe comes from a bad background, which could be part of the reason why he struggles with poverty and mental illness. You know, perhaps he was dealt a bad hand in life. That happens. But surprisingly, he actually grew up in a wealthier area in San Diego on a little island called Coronado. Maybe you guys have heard of it. He also has a very loving mother who is always there for her son. She would constantly come to Alpha Square practically every day, and she just made sure that he always had groceries and clean laundry. Even as he was growing up, his mother tried her best to get him all the help that he needed for schizophrenia. Court records show that his illness grew very serious when he was around the age of 22, which coincides with the very beginning of his criminal activity. His mother would ask help from mental health professionals, courts, police, just anybody who would listen. But unfortunately, he just kept getting worse, and his mother is just devastated at losing her son. I mean, I can't even imagine how hard that would be as a mother. I definitely don't blame the mom. I think she did everything right in the circumstance. She clearly loves her son. And that's honestly the most that you could do, you know? Mental illness is just a really, really hard thing for people to beat. And it's a huge problem. It really is. So, you know, my heart goes out to her, truly. So, Guerrero is facing 3 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of attempted murder, and 2 counts of arson. And surprisingly, he did not plead not guilty by reason of insanity. Which, in this case, I mean, if he has the history of schizophrenia, I would say that that would be a pretty good thing to go by, you know? But he didn't. After more than 3 years of court proceedings, David eventually does plead guilty and is sentenced to 4 life sentences without parole, plus 143 years to life as of last January of this year. So this case has been pending for a really long time, and when I actually added it to my list of cases that I wanted to talk about, it was still pending. But now it is nice to know that, you know, we have some conclusion. And although this is a very sad case, I am glad that justice is being served and that the victims and their families can all have closure. So with that pretty much wraps up today's episode. Let's all take some time today to really appreciate all the wonderful things we have in life. I know it's so easy to take things for granted, even something as simple as just having a roof over your head. So let's all focus on the blessings that we do have, whether that be a place to call home, our health, having loving friends or family, or even just being able to sit down and enjoy a true crime episode. Thank you guys so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe.